Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2013, Dwayne Johnson, who is known as Lee, was working as a school groundskeeper in the Benicia, California Unified School District, where he routinely sprayed large amounts of weed-killing pesticides on school grounds. Two of them were Monsanto's Roundup and Ranger Pro. One day, an accident on the job left him soaked in the herbicide. He knew that the chemicals were toxic, but he had been repeatedly told that Monsanto's products were the safest out there. Many months later, odd-looking scaly lesions popped up on his skin. His entire body, including his face and scalp, was eventually covered in painful sores. He spent months seeing doctors and getting tests to try to find answers. Lee had health insurance through the school district, but the deductibles and the copays added up very fast. In 2014, when he was just 42, Lee was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. After another accident with Roundup and another painful flare-up, he was convinced that his cancer was connected to the Monsanto chemicals he'd been spraying. In 2016, he sued the company. 2 years later, in August 2018, after a month-long trial in San Francisco, Lee was awarded $289 million in damages after jurors determined that Monsanto's herbicides caused his cancer. They also said Monsanto fought science for decades, ignored experts' warnings, pressured scientists to lie, and helped ghostwrite their own scientific studies that encouraged the use of the herbicides. Lee Johnson was the first person to take the agrochemical giant to trial. He finally received his settlement last year after a judge slashed the amount to $20.5 million. After taxes and legal fees, Lee only ended up with a fraction of the settlement. In her new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice, today's guest, investigative journalist Kerry Gillum, writes about Lee's story and the groundbreaking Monsanto Papers, which expose the great lengths Monsanto went to hide how dangerous its glyphosate herbicides were. She also writes about many other cancer patients who told her of their own battles with the disease, their hopes for survival, and their anger and frustration with a regulatory system that allows cancer-causing chemicals to poison people and our planet. Kerry Gillum is an investigative journalist and researcher with U.S. Right to Know. That's a nonprofit focusing on promoting transparency for public health. She is also the author of Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Hi, Kerry. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is really amazing. It was so fascinating to learn about what goes on behind the scenes, how lawyers prepare for these cases, what actually happened in the courtroom. I mean, I couldn't put it down. You have spent so much time with Lee and other cancer victims. Can you talk about why you decided to write this book and tell their stories?
Sure. No, well, thank you. Right. After I wrote Whitewash, which was much more of an academic, I guess, book to read, and I was following these cases, of course, very closely and getting to know a lot of the plaintiffs and watching Lee's case unfold. And I just became fascinated by the legal maneuverings and what all goes into the mass tort system and to bringing these type of claims to court, to a jury, to handle. And I just became fascinated. And the way that the story, particularly Lee's story, unfolded, I just kept saying to myself, this is like a movie. This is unbelievable, the things that are happening. I've got to write a book about this because this is just too incredible. And unlike the first book, which I wasn't sure, that anybody would actually want to read a book about a pesticide, this book to me was about people and about people who are, trying to take care of their families and trying to just live a good life like Lee was. And then they're stricken by cancer and then they're just trying to survive. But they also want to hold the company accountable that they feel is to blame for their circumstance. And the lawyers that were involved and the hoops that they had to jump through. And it was a fun book to write, actually. And I'm glad that people are enjoying reading it.
Well, I hope someone turns it into a documentary or a movie, because it really did read like that. And again, I hope people take the time to read this, because it's fascinating to learn about what goes on behind the scenes. It was also really interesting to learn more about Lee, because we had you on talking about Monsanto. We had you on again talking about the case. There were so many media stories. But I learned so much more about Lee's background, about his dreams for his family. Can you just tell us a little bit more about Lee? I mean, this job was a really good job. It paid a good wage. It allowed him to rent a nice home for his family in Vallejo. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, Lee is a really impressive person. And it takes a while to sort of peel back the layers, you know, to Lee. He has a lot of defenses and walls up, but once you get in there, he's a remarkable individual. He grew up in Vallejo in, you know, California, and did not have an easy childhood. His father was not present. His mother was often not present, was raised mainly by his grandma, struggled in school, struggled with the law, fathered a child when he was still very young himself, and really struggled to find his place in the world. But by his 40s, he seemed to have figured that out and had this really good job as a groundskeeper, is married, has two little boys, and is really taking pride in the fact that he's earning, you know, a good income and can have a nice home for his family, and is doing what we call the dirty work, you know, getting dirty, spraying pesticides and other chemicals and trapping rodents and, you know, being the groundskeeper for Benicia School District. And he really was proud of it and very dedicated to his family and wanting to, more than anything, make sure that he was there for his boys as they grew up, since he didn't have a father when he was growing up.
And as part of his job, as you report, he would mix up a 50-gallon drum of weed killer and then spray the concoction over a hilly area between two schools that held baseball and soccer fields. And you report that he did this very often, mixing and applying products such as Roundup, Monsanto's Roundup, and Ranger Pro.
Yeah, and when he takes you through he did this on a regular basis, and but wore protective equipment and was aware that, you know, these chemicals could be dangerous, but had always been told through the training and everything that these Monsanto products were particularly safe, a lot safer than others. But the story about his exposure is quite unusual. In addition to this daily sort of routine exposure, he had one particularly dramatic accident in which a tank sprayer broke, the hose broke off, and it created this giant fountain, he sort of describes it, of this weed killer. And it was, you know, getting everywhere and running down into what would be a route to a waterway. And so he just sort of threw himself into the middle of that and tried to shut it off and fix it and clean it all up, and got this extraordinary exposure. And then later developed this cancer that manifests, particularly it's a non-Hodgkin lymphoma, but manifests in the skin, in the tissue of the skin. And so his tumors are shown throughout his body, on his skin, his torso, his legs, his face, his scalp. Just a really awful, painful visualization of how cancer can be so devastating.
I mean, reading about how painful it is, it sounds like it was absolutely horrific. At one point, he told his wife, "I just want to die." He told her sobbing. He cried on a regular basis. Seeing the photos, I was just watching a video of Lee talking recently, and we'll play a clip, but he still has so many lesions on his skin. I mean, it looks painful.
Yeah, when you see, and it ebbs and flows, you know, he gets radiation treatments and things, and that will kind of smooth areas out for a while. But spending so much time with Lee, it really did impress me the level of suffering that he has had to go through, because these lesions or tumors on his skin, you know, will open up and ooze and bleed, and they're sore, and it hurts him to wear clothing. It hurts to have anything touch his skin. He likes to wear as much clothing as possible all over his body, very soft, so that no air can touch it, so no person can touch it, so no sunlight. And but just wearing clothes is painful. And I remember when I finally got him to show me his right foot, because his feet have always been particularly difficult for him to wear shoes and socks. And his right foot, he had this lesion that was open and it looked all the way down to the bone. And I just turned away and started crying. Like, I couldn't believe that a person could endure that kind of, you know, suffering. Mm.
Well, let's hear a clip from Lee Johnson. This is Lee speaking in June 2019. He now speaks across the country about his experience. And in this clip, he is talking with advocacy groups in Hawaii about his days spraying Roundup as a groundskeeper in California. Here is Lee Johnson.
I used to get there early in the morning when it was dark, put on my PPE, go in there and mix up. PPE is personal protection equipment. Those are what, I don't know why this guy's not wearing that, but it's a, if you ever seen a Tyvek suit people paint in, I used to wear that. I used to wear water resistant and chemical resistant boots, and the gloves that he's wearing up to my elbows, a little green dishwasher gloves, but a lot thicker. So, what happened to me is that I had a big 150-gallon sprayer that you mix with herbicide and water on the back of my truck. The sprayer became, the hose became detached from the tank. The hook to a Honda engine is rum, 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 running, and the juice is coming out of the hose. The hose became detached because I was all the way maxed out with my stretch, and it came off of the unit. At this point, liquid is funneling just out of that tank, you know what I mean? Because it's a power sprayer, so the engine is pumping it still. So I got in there to turn that off because my safety switch was not working. It wouldn't turn it off. So I had to get inside the truck and get showered with this stuff. It went down in my Tyvek suit. It went everywhere on my face, all kind of places. So, and the liquid is still running down the street. So I had to build a little dam of mud and whatever and dirt I could find and stop it from getting into the waterways because the drain was right near it, maybe a few feet down from where I was at. So I stopped that, and then I ended up stopping the liquid and ended up going back to the shop, getting cleaned up, changing shirts, and went back to work. Another time I was exposed, I was spraying with a backpack sprayer for probably about 2-3 hours, and my back became really wet. Now, the nose didn't feel like sweat. It felt like liquid. And this was after I was already diagnosed with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma when I was using the backpack. But I had to keep using it because it was my job, and I couldn't just switch jobs. But I was in the process of trying to get out of it. But I ended up with the backpack on and ended up exposed again. And it was just worse for me. So I got really sick, and I've been sick for 5 years. And before I sprayed Ranger Pro, before I touched any pesticides, I had flawless skin, no problems, no health problems, didn't even have health care. So this is something that has definitely changed my life.
That is Lee Johnson talking to advocacy groups in Hawaii about his days spraying Roundup as a school groundskeeper in the Benicia, California Unified School District. In 2014, Lee was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. In August 2018, after a month-long trial, he was awarded $289 million in damages after jurors determined that Monsanto's herbicides caused his cancer. The judge slashed that settlement drastically, and we'll find out why that happened. We're speaking with Carrie Gillum about this entire story. Her new book is called The Monsanto Papers. Carrie, it was so interesting to also learn in your book that Lee started to try to find answers online. He was researching information about the toxicity of Monsanto's products. But as far as he could tell, there was no one else like him, no one who developed this type of cancer from using a Monsanto weed. And so he decided to call Monsanto directly to talk to Monsanto about this. Tell us what happened at that point.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he's, you know, pretty, he's not shy for sure. So he first called, there's a poison control hotline. He called and asked information, and then he called Monsanto directly and spoke to one of their, you know, safety control people. And so it was a very nice woman, and she listened. And we can see in internal Monsanto documents that then came out through litigation that this woman, you know, took notes and listened to him. And then she passed this information up the chain to one of their product safety managers and said, hey, this guy is very worried, you know, and he wants to know if this can cause cancer. And he would like someone to call him back. And this woman promised him that someone would. And this is when Lee was trying to determine if he should continue working. He'd already been diagnosed with cancer. He was nervous about continuing to spray these products. And he was just looking for answers. No one ever called him back. He did keep spraying until he had a second accident and his cancer came back, you know, with just flared up even worse. And then he was told his condition was terminal after that. So that was one of the elements that came out at trial.
And as you report, of course, the loss of income hit the family so hard. At one point, they had a large backyard. They had a large kitchen, a really nice place for their entire family. But because he lost his income, they had to move into a tiny two-bedroom ground floor apartment. So in addition to the pain that Lee felt, as you write, he would cry quietly into his pillow, trying not to wake his boys or his wife. They had to completely downsize because his income was hit so hard.
Yeah, I mean, they really were struggling for quite some time. And they lived in this little apartment in Vallejo near the highway. And, you know, they got broken into and there really wasn't a lot of space. And Lee told me he just hated it so much. He hated living there. It was dark and cramped and he felt like it was dirty and it was not the way he wanted his boys to be living or where he wanted them to be raised. And that was part of the psychological, you know, emotional pain that he was dealing with as he saw his life, you know, and his dreams sort of ebb away from him. Mm-hmm. It's been a very sad sort of thing to write about and to get to know Lee. For many, as I told my publisher when I was writing this book, I was convinced that the last chapter would be his funeral. Every time I visited with him, I couldn't believe that he was still hanging on. But he told me at one point, sort of midway through, that he had decided he wasn't going to die. He was going to be there for his boys. It didn't matter that all the doctors said he was going to die. He just wasn't going to. Mm. And so far, he hasn't.
It's incredible. And he's still traveling around the country, sharing his story and meeting with advocates and politicians.
Well, I think COVID has put quite a damper on that. And, right. You know, it is very difficult for him to travel. I think the last time, a year or so ago, we met in Los Angeles. It was shortly before COVID kicked in. But I don't think he's been traveling much since then.
Right. Of course, COVID. Let's talk a little bit about Roundup. As you report, Monsanto may be best known for its introduction in the 1970s of a weed killing chemical called glyphosate. The primary ingredient in Roundup is glyphosate. And as you write, Monsanto knew that there was evidence glyphosate was a human carcinogen as early as the 1980s.
Well, so yes, glyphosate is sort of has been the bread and butter for this company, Monsanto. Monsanto is now owned by Bayer. Bayer had the unfortunate experience of buying Monsanto right as the Johnson trial started in June of 2018. But glyphosate, Monsanto patented it in 1974 as a very effective weed killer. They marketed it as safer, you know, than anything else really on the market to kill weeds. And, it's exploded in use, particularly after Monsanto introduced genetically engineered crops that were designed to be sprayed right over the top as they were growing with this weed killer, glyphosate, Roundup Ready crops and Roundup herbicide. So, but if you track back, and I wrote about this in Whitewash as well, if you track back through the EPA archives and look at scientific studies and reports going back into the 80s, you see there were questions about this causing cancer, showing that it caused unusual tumors in rodents that were dosed with this chemical back in the 80s. And the EPA scientists wrote memos saying this looks like it could cause cancer. You know, we should probably rate this as likely to cause cancer, possibly causes cancer. And Monsanto, you see in those early documents, pushing back on the EPA and saying, absolutely not. You're not interpreting this data correctly. Let us tell you how to interpret this data. And you see over and over and over in the documents, scientists, regulatory officials questioning this and looking for more answers, and Monsanto always pushing back and saying, we're not going to do more studies. We'll tell you how to address this and how this should be considered. And that, you know, that's what's been going on for 40 years.
And then in 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, announced that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen, which got international media attention.
Yeah, it really did. And this was not super surprising for people, you know, who'd been like myself, who'd been following the science for all of these years. You know, this was an accumulation of literature, epidemiology, toxicology, mechanistic data done by independent researchers around the world for many, many years. And the International Agency for Research on Cancer did what its job is to do, and did a review of all of the different scientific studies and the research that had accumulated, and looked at, you know, the weight of that evidence, and determined that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen with a particular association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. They saw that in some epidemiology studies, and issued their classification in March of 2015. And that's when this Roundup litigation really got underway in the United States, was shortly after that.
It was also interesting to read about lawyers who closely follow carcinogens, lawyers who sue multinational corporations around a variety of public health issues, whether it's pharmaceutical companies or in this case, Monsanto. And it was fascinating to read about lawyers from different parts of the country who did not yet know each other, who were all following the news about glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. And tell us what really stood out for you when you learned about how these lawyers work behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, your listeners are probably aware. I mean, when you talk about plaintiff's attorneys or mass tort or class action, in some circumstances, there's a bit of a stigma. You know, people sometimes refer to these lawyers as ambulance chasers, trying to prey on people who are injured or sickened or vulnerable by medical devices or products. And so there's, you know, and there's been efforts in Washington, D.C. to pass, you know, legislation to rein in the plaintiff's bar, to limit these types of cases, to limit punitive damages that can be awarded. But what I saw, and this is what I wanted to explore, there's a lot of good, bad, and ugly. You know, when you look at sort of how these mass tort attorneys work, there's a system, there's a strategy. They recognize, they watch IARC, they watch FDA, they watch for medical devices or products that have been deemed to be a carcinogen or to be defective in some way. Takata airbags, you know, they're found to be exploding. And then they step in and they find the victims of this and bring them together and then do the discovery, do all of the legwork to gather the evidence to bring this to a jury. And this type of work, you know, the plaintiffs aren't paying for this. These lawyers put their own money on the line. It's often millions of dollars that they have to spend up front to get the evidence, to get the expert witnesses, to do the research, many, many years often before anything goes to trial. And it's really interesting because, you know, if they lose, I mean, then they're just done. They've lost millions of dollars. If they win, they can sometimes achieve, you know, really significant, not only jury verdicts, bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars for people who have been injured, but they many times can force companies, you know, to change their ways or to put warning labels on products. Or in the case of Roundup and glyphosate, many countries have been convinced to restrict or ban glyphosate herbicides because of all the information that's come out through this litigation. So, you know, on the one hand, people say, oh, they're taking advantage of people who are harmed. Mm-hmm. And look at these plaintiffs. They're not going to wind up with very much money, but the lawyers are going to be rich, which if they win, that could be a true statement. But on the other hand, if you don't have these lawyers doing this work, who's going to hold these companies accountable? not the regulators, not our lawmakers. You look at every, you know, example after example of products and medical devices and opioids and everything. You know, if you don't have these lawyers out there doing the work that our regulators should be doing and our lawmakers should be doing, there's no one to stand up for the little guy. There's no one to stand up for Lee Johnson.
And if Lee Johnson never had connected with the Miller firm, who knows if this case would have even happened. One day, Lee got a pop-up ad on his computer that said, if you're a victim of Roundup's effects, you're not alone. It was an ad from the Miller firm, which ended up representing Lee Johnson in court. And we'll talk more about that after a quick break. We're speaking with Carrie Gillum, an investigative journalist and researcher for U.S. Right to Know, a nonprofit focusing on promoting transparency for public health. Her new book is called The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Carrie Gillum about her new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. Carrie, as I mentioned before the break, Lee Johnson got a pop-up ad on his computer like so many other people did. If you're a victim of Roundup's effects, you're not alone. Several law firms and attorneys had been investigating Monsanto for a while, like we mentioned, and they were completely inundated from the ad and from the 800 number. Dozens of people were swamping law offices with stories of their exposure and their cancer diagnoses. So what happens at that point? How do lawyers sift through all these stories?
And this was happening for many firms, right? Many people. There are now over 100,000 people in the United States who are considered plaintiffs in this current mass tort Roundup litigation. That's a lot of people with cancer and a lot of people who, you know, blame that cancer on their exposure to these Roundup herbicides. The lawyers, you know, it becomes very much like a machine or a manufacturing facility, really. In some cases, you know, there's intake coordinators and they bring in the information and they set up files and, you know, people are designated to get back to people. But it's a very big business, this business of mass tort litigation. And, you know, some firms perhaps are better at it than others. The firms that were handling the lead in the Roundup litigation and Lee's firm, the Miller firm out of Virginia, you know, are perhaps, you know, the biggest and the best in the business. They do a lot of this. This was their first pesticide case. None of them had ever really dealt with agrochemicals. None of them had ever sued Monsanto. You know, at the very beginning of all this litigation, I remember, you know, they didn't really know what glyphosate was. But they got up to speed very quickly, and the Miller firm jumped in and demanded discovery very early on and got Monsanto to turn over many millions of pages of internal documents. And, you know, that's really how the case was built, was on the scientific research and on the internal Monsanto documents showing how badly the company wanted to hide, manipulate, you know, alter the record about what the science was showing.
That was another fascinating part of your book, to read about the fight between, for example, Lee Johnson's eventual lawyers and the Monsanto lawyers. And we should just say that Monsanto brought in $15 billion per year in annual sales. And so they had some top-notch, very, very expensive lawyers who wanted to keep all of this information private. Can you talk about what is involved when lawyers try to get their hands on the millions of documents that the lawyers who eventually represented people like Lee were able to get from Monsanto, because so many of these documents were damning?
Yeah. I mean, that was really interesting as well. And the document, just the document management, it was a very, very expensive part of this process for these plaintiffs' attorneys. But, you know, they went in early and they submitted their discovery. They met with, I talk about in the book, you know, the getting together with this team of Monsanto attorneys and sitting down and trying to outline what they wanted to do. But you see over and over in the book how much Monsanto fought turning over these documents. And once they turned them over, how they fought to keep them secret. When documents are turned over like this in discovery in a public court action, they should be presumably open to the public. They should be able to be filed in court and the people should be able to see them unless they deal with some, you know, confidential business, you know, strategy or something like that. And Monsanto was arguing that all of these documents were confidential business strategy. And of course, many, many of them were not. So the lawyers had to go back and forth and the judge had to get involved many times. And there were many fights between the lawyers that got quite heated. And we talk about in the book, you know, one particular sort of climactic event that happened that resulted in sort of the dominoes starting to fall when one of the lawyers and his firm just said, you know what, we're gonna push these documents out because we think the world needs to see them. You know, there are too many people using this product every day. They need to know what they've been lied to about. So that was a pretty dramatic part of the story to watch that happen.
Yeah, that was so dramatic. So that was Brett Wisner, the lawyer who just after midnight on August 1st, 2017, gave the legal team the go-ahead to publish these memos, which, of course, the media immediately wrote about this. This became a bombshell, which eventually became known as the Monsanto Papers. The Sierra magazine, that's the Sierra Club, reviewed your book, gave your book a glowing review, and they wrote that the Monsanto Papers is essential reading for anyone who wants to understand the dangers of glyphosate to human health and the corrupt system of corporate and political influence that enabled Monsanto to sell its toxic weed killer for decades. This was really a pivotal moment in the entire story and also in your book, just to look at what happened after these papers were released.
Yeah, it really was. And Brent, you know, it wasn't a unanimous decision. You know, some of the other lawyers involved, there were several firms that were leading the litigation as a team effort by that point, including Lee's firm, the Miller firm, and Brent's firm was Baum Hedlund in Los Angeles. And then the Wagstaff firm out of Colorado and Weitz and Luxembourg out of New York. But Brent wanted to push these out. And he and Michael Baum, the managing partner there, talked about it. And they told me, you know, we feel like these documents need to be in the hands of regulators around the world right now and consumers and lawmakers, people right now, whether or not we win this case or lose this case, people around the world need to see what has really been going on for all of these years. And Brent, you know, figured out the protective order and went through it with a fine tooth comb and figured out a strategy in which he could get these documents out without violating the protective order that the federal judge had put in place over these documents. And so it was very dramatic and it all had to be timed exactly correctly. And he had to hope and pray that Monsanto's attorneys didn't get wise to what he was planning and try to, you know, interfere or rush to court to block it. And he was able to release them, yes, just after midnight on August 1st. And he also sent packages around the world with copies of the documents and a cover letter to regulatory agencies trying to call their attention to this because he felt that more so than winning a case, it was important to alert people to the public health issues that the documents revealed.
And as you write, Roundup became so widely used all over the world. What effect did these papers have on, for example, school districts that use Roundup, individuals that use Roundup? You write, millions of people were still using Roundup and other Monsanto glyphosate-based brands, and most still believed that they did not need to take precautions when they sprayed the chemical concoctions.
Right. Well, because you see advertisements, you see people out there in flip-flops and shorts or barefoot, and they're spraying it, and they're not wearing gloves and that sort of thing. And you know, this is the way it's always been thought of. I myself used to, you know, grab a bottle of Roundup and go out in my backyard in the summertime and, you know, spray all the little weeds that I could find. Mm-hmm. But when you see in the documents how you see the dermal absorption data and you see all of this other information about what it's doing to, you know, laboratory animals who are dosed with this and the effects on their health, and you see how Monsanto is telling its employees internally to be sure to wear, you know, gloves and long sleeves and long pants if they're going to be spraying this chemical. It just was so alarming to see the disconnect between what the company talked about internally and what the like saying, you know, we can't say it doesn't cause cancer. We haven't done the studies to know if it causes cancer, essentially. When you look at that and the documents that showed how Monsanto was paying these public, these front groups and working with third parties to try to promote the safety of the product. They wanted it to look like it was coming from third parties. They were engineering these ghostwritten articles in scientific journals and other places. I mean, it was just a vast effort to deceive the public and deceive regulators. And these Monsanto papers just blew that all up.
Today, we're speaking with Carrie Gillum, who writes about all of this in her new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. Carrie tells the story of Lee Johnson, a California groundskeeper, a school groundskeeper, who won a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against Monsanto in 2018 after he was exposed to Roundup and got cancer. A jury unanimously found that Monsanto failed to warn of the dangers of its products, which Johnson used on a regular basis. Carrie Gillum is an investigative journalist and a researcher for U.S. Right to Know. That's a nonprofit focusing on promoting transparency for public health. Carrie, we have a comment on social media from Tom, who writes, "My uncle worked at Monsanto for many years. About maybe a decade after he quit, he developed cancer and eventually died. While he could not prove he got it from working there, he told me that he suspected it was a result from long-term exposure to the chemicals he worked around." And it's just so sad. I'm so sorry to hear about this, Tom. I'm sure you've heard these stories over and over again.
I get emails every 3 or 4 a week, probably. Wow. Not every day, but from people who have lost a spouse or a good friend, or they themselves are suffering from non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and they have been exposed to this chemical, used it in their job, or, you know, over and over again. And the suffering, and this is why I dedicated my book to these people, to all of these people who are suffering from cancer, and not just cancer from that's associated with this chemical, you know, because again, the point of all of my work and this book and all the books is it's not one company and one chemical and one cancer, right? We are literally poisoning our environment when we allow these toxic chemicals that these giant companies tell us, you know, we have to use them. We need them to grow our food or to make sure we don't have weeds in our parks or playgrounds. They tell us we need these chemicals. Well, do we? Maybe we do, maybe we don't, but we need to fully understand the risks that come with this. And, you know, when we don't understand that, cancer is a result. It's quite clear. Our scientific research, many, many years of scientific research around from around the world shows us that these chemicals are contributing to cancer. And here in the United States, 40% of men and women are expected to get cancer in their lifetimes.
40%?
39.8%. yes. And
that is a huge percentage.
That just is a percentage. I think that, but if your listeners think about it, think about how many people do they know who have cancer?
Too many. Sure, you know, it's so interesting, Carrie. I feel like I hear about a friend or a friend of a friend almost every, maybe one a week or every 2 weeks.
Right.
All ages, too. It's
well, become, and if you look at our national, our national toxicology program and our NIEHS, our own government scientists are well aware of this and have been trying to raise the alarm. And you can read the long, lengthy reports that I have read saying environmental contaminants, pesticides, other chemicals that we are pushing out there and allowing into our food, our air, our water, they are causing, you know, cancer. Increasingly, we're seeing a number of cancers in children. We're seeing reproductive health. There's a new book out by a scientist called Countdown, about fertility problems that are on the rise around the world that are associated with exposure to pesticides and other chemicals. this is serious business. This isn't, again, just about Lee Johnson and Monsanto and one herbicide. This is a toxic environment that we are allowing, to destroy the health and the reproductive, future for our kids. And I think they deserve a better legacy, but there are a lot of powerful influences out there telling us, don't worry about those pesticides in your food. Don't worry about the chemicals in your water and your air and your soil. And you'll be fine and you can live with cancer and you can radiate and cut off body parts and chemo and you'll be fine. And I don't think we should be living that way.
Carrie Gillum is an investigative journalist, and I hope you can take the time to read her important new book, The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. We have a number of callers who've been waiting patiently, so let's go through a few of them, and then we'll get Carrie to respond. Let's go first to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Hello. Thank you. excuse me. While this man's story is horrific, as you've indicated, this is happening across the country, around the world. In the state of California, we have a Prop 65, which was passed by the voters. It's been in place for decades. I'm sure your guest knows about it. The only problem is that all the that needs to be done with regard to a known chemical that's a carcinogen or causes reproductive health is for a warning to be put up. And if you go into any gas station, you're going to see that warning because of gasoline. But another chemical that is ubiquitous is diesel exhaust. We're being exposed to this every day, everywhere. The problem is this is such a gigantic failure on the part of public health because even if you know, and there are thousands of chemicals on that Prop 65 list, that's all they need to do is give a warning. And then it's going to be up to you if you should incur some kind of health problem, cancer, etc., for you to sue them if that's possible. So this is a total failure, to my mind, on the part of public health and on companies and even public entities that know this is a problem and really don't do anything to try and do more than just warn people that it's a known carcinogen.
Well, thank you for that, Greg. And for those who live out of California, Prop 65 requires California to publish a list of chemicals known to cause things like cancer, birth defects, or reproductive harm. And then it requires businesses to provide warnings to people about exposures. And I think a lot of people probably have just gotten used to seeing the label and maybe don't even pay attention to it at this point. But we'll get a response from Carrie after we take a few more callers. Let's go to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I apologize if you covered this because I missed part of the show, but from several authors about Vietnam during the war, it was learned that they more commonly used other types of Agent Orange. There were other colors. There was at least 6, maybe 10 other colors, Agent Purple, Agent Green, Agent Brown, and they were much higher concentrations of dioxin. But what they told the public was that they used Agent Orange for, political and legality reasons because of the obvious fallout from after effects and mutations of children and all that. But the concentrations that were actually used were much higher, and they had different names, like I mentioned, the other colors. So I'll take a response on the effects.
Okay, thank you. And Carrie briefly writes about Agent Orange in her book. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go next to Pam in Oakland. Hi, Pam. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My name is Pam. I write about vineyards and pesticides, and I, of course, followed your work, Carrie, for many years. I love the book. I just want to say how fabulous it is and what a popular sort of book it should become, because it really is a personal story. But my question is, in the aftermath of all of this, what has been the response from the EPA or our new administration? Is labeling now required? And why is Roundup as popular as ever, or is it facing declining sales?
Thank you. Great questions. We'll take one more caller and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Carrie. You may remember me. I was a juror on Lee's trial.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, I'll just try to keep this short, but it's a really interesting conversation. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but the thing that's been frustrating to me as these, you know, years have passed since the trial is you referenced this very briefly before, the victims in the various settlements don't get very much money. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much Lee got, and a lot of the stuff is one of the problems. It's all confidential what the settlements are. Bear paid out $10 billion, but when you do the math, you know, the people who settled in that settlement get, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. And even in Lee's trial, you know, Monsanto stipulated that Lee's damages were, tens of millions of dollars. So in a way he's, you know, lucky because he didn't settle or couldn't settle and is actually getting much, much less than we awarded him, but he's getting a substantial amount of money, which hopefully helps him and his family. But you sort of went through, Carrie, you kind of went through quickly, the lawyers are the kind of the last resort, the last backstop, and I totally agree with that. But then you kind of said, well, then without, you know, legislators have failed and the regulators have really failed.
Robert, we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure that Carrie has enough time to respond. So Lee was awarded $289 million in damages, and then a judge slashed the amount to $20.5 million, but after taxes and legal fees, he ended up with a fraction of the settlement. Can you tell us more about how that works and why it works like that? What happened?
Me?
Yes. Yes, you. Yes, you, yes. Of course.
Yeah. And hi, Robert. I remember you very much. Thank you for everything. And thanks for all these questions. This was slashed a couple of different times through the appellate court decision, and it really boiled down to a matter of the fact that Lee was considered terminal and he was not expected to live very long. It was a function in California law provisions that if you're going to die and you're not going to live a long time with suffering and you're not going to have mounting, you know, medical bills over 10 or 20 or 30 years, then you shouldn't be entitled to more money. Your compensatory is going to be less, and then your punitive as a calculation of your compensatory. So it's basically a provision of California law that says, you know, if you're going to die soon, you shouldn't get more money than if you're going to live a long time, which is sort of a, you know, strange thing. But this was the rationale for cutting his verdict so substantially to $20.5 million. I agree with, you know, Greg on Prop 65. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's an effort by California to do something to warn people. But you're right, I'm not sure it has much teeth or is very effective anymore. And you know, yes, diesel, I mean, all of these things, these toxins in our environment, as we talked about, are causing profound human health problems that are lasting and that are a terrible legacy for our children. And we desperately need, you know, a balance. We need a regulatory system that is focused on public health more so than just, you know, corporate profits. And we need regulators and lawmakers that are not beholden to these giant corporations that are just pushing these toxins out into our environment. I'm not naive enough to think we can have a perfect, pristine world, you know, in which there is nothing toxic in our environment. I think we all have convenience and we like our transportation and we like, you know, things that it's a risk reward, and we have to understand the balance. Pam, thank you. Yeah, the vineyards, I mean, pesticides in vineyards, people don't understand you're going to get some chemicals and pesticides and maybe some glyphosate in your wine, unless your vineyard operators are thinking about that and trying to go with more organic or regenerative practices. The EPA, right now, I guess what I could say maybe on a hopeful note is that the Biden administration has signaled that they want to be a little different than what we saw under Trump and even what we saw under Obama and prior, that they want to take a harder look at some of these pesticides, including glyphosate. So, you know, and they want to restore scientific integrity to the EPA is what they're talking about. Biden, however, did just, you know, tell Colombia and encourage Colombia to resume its glyphosate, you know, aerial spraying of glyphosate over cocoa crops, something that's been shown to sicken people in that area and cause them great health problems. So I don't know where we are.
You know, we would love to have you back and have a roundtable, really, to talk about the EPA and what really changed under Trump and then, you know, why there's such a cozy relationship in some cases between high level people at the EPA and these corporations. There's the revolving door. And as Greg said, it's a gigantic failure on the part of public health. So we would love to have you back to talk about that. And in our remaining seconds, is Roundup as popular as it used to be, or are these lawsuits changing that?
From where I sit, I really think, you know, the lawsuits have changed it dramatically. Mm-hmm. You're seeing many countries around the world say they want to ban it. Mexico has just said that they're going to ban it, that it's all about public health there, and they want to protect their people, and they're phasing out glyphosate products by 2024. Mm-hmm. Now, Bayer, Monsanto, the U.S. government doesn't want to let them do that. They're fighting back. We shall see how that works out.
Well, Carrie, thank you for all of your incredible work. We would love to have you back. Carrie Gillum is author of The Monsanto Papers, Deadly Secrets, Corporate Corruption, and One Man's Search for Justice. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.